I can hear my brother crying. I can't breathe. We all know the solutions, but they blame you and me. Cries the powerful, passionate voices of the brother and sister of Eric Gardner, the Staten Island African-American placed in a stranglehold by an officer July 2014. Welcome to Forward Radio. This is Solutions to Violence, a program that is part of Forward Radio's public affairs educational programming. You have found us on WFMP 106.5 FM on your radio dial. The views expressed on this program are those of the guest and not that of the station or the Fellowship of Reconciliation. We here at Solutions to Violence believe in fairness. We believe in civil rights, and we believe in solving conflict without violence, as does our guest today, Deontay Hollowell and Deborah Barnes Byers.
I'm Jamie McMillan, here with Jim Johnson as your co-host for Solutions to Violence. Our technical engineer is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. Our guests today are Dr. Deontay Hollowell and Ms. Deborah Barnes Byers. Welcome, Deontay and Deborah, to Solutions to Violence. It's a huge pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Dr. Hollowell is an assistant professor of history and African-American studies in the School of Liberal Studies at Spalding University. He refers to himself as a champion of education on all levels. He enjoys teaching and designing courses as well as researching, reading, and writing. Community organizing is also a strength and a passion of his, as he has supported positive social change and educated community members about social issues. He has taught in the JCTC Prison Education Program.
Deborah Barnes Byers is the project manager for the Pivot to Peace program under the umbrella of the Peace Education Program in Louisville. This program has been functional since April 2016. This program works with gunshot and stab victims from ages 14 to 36, living in Jefferson County. The program has recently been expanded to those also living at high risk of violence and high risk behaviors. Dr. Hollowell and she have worked together in the Pivot for Peace for 3.5 years. He is the project manager assistant for the program.
So for our listeners not familiar with Spalding University, this is a landmark university in Louisville, Kentucky. So Dr. Hollowell, how did you come to Spalding? Please give us a little background on it and what you like best about teaching there.
I've been at Spalding since 2009. I started there as an adjunct teaching history courses. I was introduced to the chair, John Wilcox. At the time he was a chair, he's not a chair anymore. He was teaching history courses and he was looking for someone to relieve him on the adjunct level. So I applied for the position and got it, and I started teaching pretty much one course every so often there. And then in 2014, I started full-time.
So your doctorate is in what?
In African American Studies from okay. Temple University, okay. Philadelphia.
So what are some of your favorite academic specialties and areas of interest?
So my dissertation was on the historical implications of the relationship between African American communities and police. I finished that in 2008. So that's kind of been my study area of passion, if you will, since then. But I've done a whole lot of other research as well in the areas of specifically African American history, and I'm working on a couple of projects now regarding the history of slavery in Kentucky, and also a couple of courses in slavery and policing, and even some world history courses.
But you teach an African American history course at Spalding, right?
I teach several.
You teach several, so why is that important to you?
Well, it's just, to me, important for us to write the wrongs that history has done, unjustly so, to the black experience in America. And so when I was growing up and learning black history from white professors, or from white teachers rather, in school, it was few and far between what I was able to learn. I had a teacher once in high school tell me that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. didn't deserve a holiday in his honor, that he was nothing but a rebel rouser and a protester who separated America and was a race baiter. And I had no choice but to believe that because I had no one else teaching me the truths about my people. Hmm. And so those experiences growing up were the ones that kind of stuck with me as I was deciding what career path I wanted to take. And so once I did come upon truths that I learned throughout the years, I wanted to make sure that everybody, not just black students and not just students in general, but that everybody had exposure to the truths about not just black history, but American history too.
Absolutely. As a former social studies, Jefferson County Public School social studies teacher, I went through the whole 6th grade through 12th grade social studies curriculum. I know it leaves out most of the African American history. It's a pretty cursory curriculum and something that has bothered me greatly ever since then.
Well, I can say from my own experience, I'm a little older than I think both of you guys, but I had nothing in my high school experience and even college about African American history. So I was very uneducated, deficit of education in my early years and college years. I'm glad to see it's coming along, you know, but it's not gone there. Are you aware of the New York Times piece on 1619?
Yes, I am. Yeah, yeah, I'm aware of that. I'm still reading. It's very long.
So am I. Yeah, it's a whole magazine and also supplements in the regular New York Times.
What's that piece? Can you
tell me about it?
I honestly don't remember the name of it, but
1619.
It's basically revisiting the 400-year anniversary of the date 1619, which a lot of historians agree was the first Jamestown settlement, the first prevalence of chattel slavery in the United States. I personally don't necessarily agree with that date, but I'm okay with it as an historian. I assume that chattel slavery had been going on in the U.S. Prior to 1619, but I also know that blacks came to the Americas way before they came here as slaves, and even the years before Christ, you had Africans coming here from Egypt and Nubia to help preserve what is known now as Mexican-American culture. Mm-hmm. But that's an aside. The piece is good. It's very in-depth about the history of slavery in the United States. I think it's a good piece, but I'm not finished reading it, though.
Yeah.
And here also at St. Stephen's Baptist Church, they had a 400-year commemorative ceremony, which was very diverse and very interdenominational. And there were readings that were done, and the congregation, there were readings for white people, and there were readings for blacks. And the whites were asked to stand and apologize. And it listed some of the things because, as Deontay was talking earlier, I don't think present day people really realize some of the harm and the hurt and the damage that was done to human beings during that time. And it was very emotional because, like I said, a lot of people didn't realize the damage that was done. They think of slavery, they only superficially, you know, they worked the fields if they got beat, but they listed everything that they could remember that happened to people, human beings. And
we're still learning.
Yes. And so, you know, it was emotional for me, and it was emotional as a black woman, but it was also emotional for the white sisters and brothers. So it was very, very relative and important. And so we, as black people, once they apologized to the different things that had been done to us, we forgave. And I think, you know, our part was to forgive everything that they said that they did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was, you know, because what they're trying to do, if no place else, is move Louisville toward healing. Mm. And I know there were ceremonies or commemorative ceremonies that were done nationwide, but mm-hmm. I attended the one at St. Stephen's Baptist Church.
So you do see it as a kind of healing?
I think it before you can heal, you have to reveal. You know, you have to know. You know, we've talked about the transgenerational trauma. And it's, you know, when we talk about trauma, we often talk about blacks pulling themselves up by the bootstraps. But in order for us, you know, we can go to school, go to college, live in the great same neighborhoods, drive the same cars. But the first thing that they see is the color of our skin. So the healing is not just for black people. Mm-hmm. And it's also for white people.
Absolutely.
You know, it's changing the mindset of all people. Because we can do all that you ask us to do and be all that you ask us to be. But if you still only see us as black people, then it's just lopsided, it's one-sided. So the healing and the apology and the understanding and the realization of what was actually done to our African ancestors has to be realized and somehow settled in the souls of the white people as well.
Deontay, a faculty colloquium is about demonstrating a commitment to scholarly engagement. Tell us what your role is in the Spalding Faculty Colloquium.
I was asked to speak at the colloquium last year, and I basically did a demonstration on the class that I ended up teaching right after that, which was based on my dissertation work that I mentioned earlier in regards to the history of African Americans and police. So the class that I taught is called Policing the Black Experience. So in the colloquium, I spoke to my fellow faculty members about some ideas that I had leading up to actually teaching the class and really kind of getting some of their ideas about how to structure the class. Some of them even had ideas about different readings that I could use along with my dissertation and some of the readings I had already selected. So it turned out to be pretty well. It was well attended. I think they wanted me to speak a little longer, but I didn't really want, I thought maybe that they would be bored by some of the research that I've done. However, I did present at that colloquium and did the 6-week course, and it was pretty good. I had about 20 students in the class, and most of them done well. As a matter of fact, former Mayor Jerry Abramson, who's also faculty at Spalding, he came and spoke. But it was a great class. The work is good, and I'm looking forward to advancing that into a textbook by the time I teach the class next year in session 5. So hopefully the book they'll be using will actually be authored by me.
So the colloquium was a kind of a give and take. You got some good ideas or information from fellow staff, faculty?
Yeah, that's the essence of it, is just for President Tory McClure wants the faculty to get together once a year and have one faculty member being showcased on the work and research that they're doing and any courses that they are developing in relationship to that work. And she believes in the work that I'm doing, so she wanted to put me out there on Front Street, so to speak, give me an opportunity to let my colleagues see what it is I'm actually doing, not only in that particular class, but some of the other things that we have going on at Spalding in regards to African-American studies.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear. What other roles have you chosen in the university?
So we have an African American Studies minor now. We just graduated our first two students this summer. And so I'm basically directing that in action, maybe not in title. I'm not being paid a director salary, but I am kind of developing the coursework for the African American Studies minor. And then we also have the Black Student Alliance, and I'm the faculty advisor for that. So we have about 20 or so members right now of the Alliance.
Is that just for college students?
Technically, yes, in order to be, because it's a recognized student organization on campus. So in order to be a member of that, in order for your voice to count, so to speak, you have to be a Spalding student. However, we do a lot of programming and events off campus. One of my goals is to have the BSA to really function mostly off campus and to really do a lot of stuff as it pertains to policy change in the community, education on black history in the community, and other things like that. So I do so much stuff at Spalding, we could do a whole dissertation just on that right there.
Welcome to education.
Yeah. So you're involved in another program in the Louisville area titled Pivot to Peace. Tell us about Pivot to Peace.
Yeah, so Ms. Deborah Barnes-Byers, what, 3.5 years ago now, and I don't even remember how we met. That's kind of weird, but it seems like she's been mothering me for a long time. But we've been doing this program now for 3.5 years, and we have several case managers that kind of cater to the needs of individuals who have been traumatized by violence, whether they've been actually violated themselves by violence or whether someone, a loved one or a family member, has been the actual victim of the violence. Mm-hmm. But our program has developed and changed over the years. We started out working with just certain demographics of Louisville, but now we're citywide, Jefferson County. And we also had an age restriction, which we still do, but the age gap is widening a little bit. So it's great work. It gives a lot of resources to those individuals who believe that we can actually help them to pivot. And I always tell the young men and women in our program that it's like basketball, that in the sense of the pivot, when one foot is down, you can still move the other and turn the other way, and now you got other options on that side. Mm-hmm. And so our participants believe in it. It's an uphill battle because of the trauma that they've been either witnessed or experienced. It's not a quick fix. A lot of times they need help with educational services, employment opportunities. Sometimes they don't have health care, so we have to try to help them to understand the importance of self-care, taking care of yourself and putting yourself first. And there's a wide spread of services just depending on what the individual needs are for that person.
And so now that we've expanded to youth, because originally it was just 18 through 34.
Okay.
And now we've expanded to 14 through 36.
Okay.
And so the youth come with other needs, extra special needs, and due to trauma. And the work is really, it's not easy. It's not just walking somebody to the resources. You know, what I find is a lot of times, you know, we don't go to the root of the causes and of behavior. And even working with resources in the community, we often have to chide them because they see and then they decide why they were injured and treat accordingly, as opposed to understanding what has caused these young people to be in the situation that they are. There is a stereotyping that they all come from a criminal background, and that is not necessarily true. We have had people who have been victims of circumstances. We have people who were employed, you know, and not employed on the street, but sometimes that is the stereotype that's put on these young people based on their injury.
And unfortunately, that can leak out to how they're treated in the community or even when they go into the hospital. So it's always best for us when we meet the participant when they're actually laying in that hospital bed, because then we can make sure that they're getting the proper care in the hospital, that they are taking the right medications, that they're not getting discriminated against at the pharmacy when they go in to try to get pain medication, because oftentimes it's assumed that they should be able to deal with the pain, or that we can't give them certain medications because maybe they'll sell them or maybe they'll use them improperly. So we just really have to be attentive. And Ms. Deborah does a great job of keeping us on top of the policies in the hospitals and pharmacies, and bringing in people to speak with case managers so that we can know the rules that our participants need to play by.
So you are on the ground. This is not a classroom.
This is elbow work right here, no doubt. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the community relationship here. Let's get into that. So in 2016, the Louisville metro area reported 115 homicides, 107 in 2017. But only 80 homicides in 2018. That's a drop of more than 20%. Did Pivot to Peace have a role to play in that drop? How so?
We hope we did. We hope we did. We believe we did, because that is the ultimate goal. People don't realize that people who have been injured violently, gunshot or stabbed, there's a high rate of recidivism. So if, you know, some of our participants have come in, have been injured before, have been shot before. When we did orientation at University of Louisville Hospital, one of the doctors stated that he had a young man who had been injured and they were doing the final surgery. And before they could do that final surgery, he was shot again. So our primary goal is, number one, to show them, help them to identify the at-risk behavior that may have gotten them injured, and to help them to identify the path to prevent them from getting injured again. So our program has a 95% success rate in that we've served almost 100 participants since 2016, and only 4 have been re-injured.
Wow, okay. So liberal homicides, now the numbers fell behind 22 other cities in 2018, which is good news. But most people's standards, 80 homicides is still a lot. It's about 18% of the 100,000 citizens in the city. So how does Pivot to Peace view these numbers? Would you support new gun safety measures? And if so, what kind of gun safety measures would you support?
But I would say first that when it comes to the peace work, those measurables are very difficult to determine oftentimes. How do we know when, let's say, a young man or a young woman enters our program and they're thinking about doing harm to someone? They call their case manager. They decide not to do harm to someone. That's a murder that didn't happen. Mm. But how do you really measure that? Mm. So,
yeah. Especially since... Sorry to interrupt, especially how can we measure that those 80 that you mentioned, we didn't touch them. Hmm. So they have not had any support. So how do you evaluate that?
Sure. So what's your take on gun safety measures and
so,
new regulations?
I don't think that the Pivot to Peace program has a stance on gun safety per se that we all agree on. But what I will say is that I personally think it's important for us to reevaluate the types of guns that people are able to have, and that because assault weapons and these types of weapons like that, personally, I don't deem as necessary. I don't see the use for them. And those weapons are used in mass murders and public killings and these sorts of things. When it comes to a person's right to defend themselves, I like to leave that up to the person. Because I do respect a person's right to arm themselves in order to protect their family. So my personal view on that may not be in agreement with Ms. Deborah's or even with the peace education program.
However contractual, you cannot work with with a weapon. It's in our contracts with them, but go carry on.
Okay.
Yeah, so... But in reality, the United States has a real serious problem with violence. We watch it on TV. We listen to it in music. We celebrate it in sports. We celebritize people who murder and who kill. We watch documentaries on Jeffrey Dahmer and all of these individuals in a cult-like fashion in ways that other countries don't. And so when that manifests into the actual murders that happen, then we act like we're surprised. That I think is probably our biggest problem, is that we haven't really put the mirror on ourselves and said, this is really who we are. And the way that people view us around the world isn't far off. We have failed when it comes to really protecting our citizens. We've made the United States a mockery in safety as it pertains to how many people we allow to die to be murdered senselessly. Every year.
And the violence, going back to slavery, that was an extremely violent experience of our ancestors from Africa.
Yes.
Everything from the whippings, the raping, the separation of families, the hangings, that's violent. And unfortunately, it's something that is overlooked and sometimes is not thought about, how it has affected the United States, the people, not just the slavery. Yes, it was horrendous for us, but for those who thought it was their right to do that to other people. So,
yeah, because it's not taught in our public school systems, and I think by not teaching that African American history, we're cheating not just the African American kids, but also the white kids who don't learn that history.
Yes.
It's a trauma that lasts over generations. It's not just that one 100 years or 200 years that we're talking about. If we're talking about today, that trauma exists even today through generations. You mentioned, and we mentioned also the Peace Ed program that you're involved with. We've interviewed Director Eileen Blanton, and give us again a little information about that program and its effect on the city and community.
Peace Education is a program that the three pillars, the primary pillars, are conflict resolution, mediation, and diversity appreciation. And they are in multiple schools, like a lot of JCPS schools. As a matter of fact, they have a waiting list of schools wanting to get the program into each different school entity. We also do a training it's called Training of Educators, it's a 3-day training that involves teachers and people in the school systems. It also involves people who are working with youth. And so the goal is to teach and show that there isn't another option to violence. That what I love about it is the first day, it's all about the individual. You learn, I've seen it transition first, you know, because they celebrate everybody. You identify who you are. You learn how other people feel, and you get firsthand effect of how even your prejudice and your misinformation about other people that we often make based on appearance. And then that transcends into how we can better work with other people, how we teach, because there are five of us in this room, and none of us started on the same path. None of us has walked the same path. We all have been educated, but you don't know what each individually, what it took for us to get to this point today. And I think that is what's lacking. We need to better understand and listen to other people and be listened to. And so I celebrate the work at Peace Ed because they allow people to do that in their multiple trainings. You know, it's an individual, it's for you individually, but it also gives you an opportunity to hear people's stories and understand so that when you leave the training, your intelligence and your awareness and your ability to work with other people have been heightened.
Thank you for that. You've explained that community organizing is also a strength and a passion of yours, supporting positive social change and educating community members about social issues is another. How do you work that into your life and your profession as an educator?
Yeah, as much as I can. It's one of the fun things that I get to do with the work. Right now, I'm working with 2NOT1 for Fatherhood and Families. It's an organization based out of the California Community Center, and they've been around for over a decade.
That's California District here in Louisville.
Yeah, California, over on St. Catherine, right behind St. Stephen's Church. And 2NOT1 works with fathers and families to try to keep families together, and to try to make sure that fathers are involved in the lives of their children. My role with them has been as the director of the Rites of Passage program, which is for boys, 4th grade through 8th. And basically what we do with them, we do 2 10-week sessions each year. We start off usually around September and we go to around December. And then we'll start back in February and go to June, up to Father's Day, typically.
Same group?
Same group, yeah. And often, sometimes members come and go because their schedules may dictate that they can only come to one 10-week session, or they can only come to 3 or 4 weeks of this one or that one. And really, we just establish a brotherhood with those boys, a place where they can feel comfortable having conversations with older men. Now, it's all boys, there's no women in the room, and we really just get down to the nitty-gritty of what does it take to go from a boy to become a man, and we try to slow that process down. Oftentimes, our society looks at our young boys as men, and they say young men, Well, we don't call them young men because they're not, they're boys. And they don't deserve to become young men until they go through what is considered a rites of passage, a series of events in their life that shapes them and shapes their mentality and prepares them for manhood. And so we don't want to put that onus on them so fast that they feel like they have to be the man of the house. Now, some of those boys are in that situation. They don't have a father in the home. They don't have a male in the home, and they're the oldest male. So they have to develop some of those qualities. However, we try to get them to understand that even in that situation, you're still a boy. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to be trying to make yourself a man at this young of an age, because society, it's not fair for society to treat you that way. And to heap those expectations on you. So that program is something I've been doing for about 5 years, and it's something that I'll continue to do. I work with about 7 other mentors, and we meet with the boys on Sundays, usually for about 2 hours a Sunday. And it's rough because our mentors, they give up their Sundays to watch football, which is very important to a lot of us, but, you know, we DVR the football, and then, you know, sometimes we'll even watch the football with the young boys, but we do a lot of things with them. We teach them how to do practical applications, like to how to change oil or how to change a tire. We teach them about Black history, obviously. We teach them how to do conflict resolution, and we do traditional African rites of passage. We teach them how to fish. We teach them how to milk cows. We've taught them how to, they've taught us how to play Fortnite. I mean, so we do like a lot of different things, activity-wise, education, programming. And the folks at 2NOT1 are great to me for allowing me to really just put some type of impression upon these boys, and not just me, but the other mentors also. So we have about 20 boys in the program now.
Are you married?
I am married. Been married for 10 years.
Do you have children?
We don't have children. We've been married for 10 years, and my wife, Lori Goodwin, is an attorney with legal aid, and she ran for judge last year. So,
So you say you're going to continue with this program. What's your commitment to it? Why do you want to stay with it?
It's fun. I'm a nerd. It's something that I love to do. I get around the boys, and we often, just time flies real fast. We do a lot of serious stuff, and you brought up the fact, I mean, I don't have children, so I feel like it's incumbent upon me to take what it is I do have. Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great scholar, talked about the talented 10th and the need for people who are the so-called educated elite to give back and put their hands in the dirt and make sure that we help to raise our people that are struggling. I believe in that 100%, and I believe that it's more than me just teaching a class about African civilizations, which I'll be doing in Session 6 next year. I can do that and consider that to be my contribution, but there are so many people that will never get to take a class at Spalding. There's so many people that will never get to be in college at all. And so I've always determined that it was my responsibility to do as much as I could to make sure that, you know, I help to improve the quality of life of my people. So it's fun to me, but it's also a great responsibility.
You're advocating, obviously, a community organizing and participation. People like Bayard Rustin, the anthropologist Laura Toussaint, and others believe that in order to bring about positive change, the civil rights movement, the peace movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement, all have to form a kind of a coalition. That's what is your take on coalition building, and is it possible to organize these movements in Louisville?
Where do you start?
Yeah, I think you start from within. As a matter of fact, I don't even believe that proper coalition building can happen until organizations realize who they really are. And I think that there's two sides to that. One, organizations need to stay in their own lane and do what they do and try not to always replicate what some other organization is doing, but even when that has to happen, then we need to consult each other. And so to me, coalition building and really breaking down silos, I think, is what you're talking about. And that work has to start from within, from organizations first, having people that they trust in their organizations first, but also having a strict regimen of expectations for their organization and outline plan of the work that they're going to do. So for instance, 2-Not-1 does a certain particular thing with fatherhood and families, but there are other organizations that do work that are similar. Those organizations need to first recognize what it is they do that's different. Mm-hmm. Then they can come to the table with the other organizations that do similar work, mm-hmm. and we can work together on what I've heard to be referred to as the narrow strip of unity. So let's not worry about the fact that you're a conservative and I'm a liberal. I don't even know why people subscribe to those terms. But or that I'm black and you're white, or that she's gay and he's straight. Why don't we leave all of that off the table, come together under the umbrella of our commonalities, mm-hmm. and then see how much work we can get done.
Okay. But here in Louisville, since the death of Ann Brayton, really, the peace movement and the civil rights movement have struggled to work together to form a larger organization. How do we go about getting those two groups together?
I think it's just what I was saying. And I don't know if there's a need for another organization to be formed. I think the work is often being done on the underground level. A lot of people don't know what we do with peace education, with Pivot to Peace. With 2-Not-1, what's going on in Spalding or Uvalde or in the West End or in Beachmont, and all of these organizations exist in silos. They do the work by themselves. It's not pretty work. They don't get paid for it. It's not going to be on the news, but they do it anyway, and people don't know. So right. Exposure to those truths, I think, will help the organizations that are doing something to say, oh wow, there's a group over here that's doing something a little different. Maybe I should go talk with them and go to their neighborhood and see how what they're doing works for them. Now, what they're doing may work for them, it may not work for us, but there may be opportunities for collaborations, opportunities to learn. And I think that's being at Spalding has been a great example of that for me, because President McClure is really good about opening the doors. She'd say opening the rooms. So she wants to open the whole campus. As a matter of fact, she's doing something now where anyone who wants to change their office, I'm in the Department of Liberal Studies, right? I can go choose an office in economics if I want to now, if somebody's willing to swap with. So it's something, just doing things like that, being innovative, giving yourself opportunities to succeed, I think is what's important.
My wife does mindfulness training in the city, and she recently was just amazed, a group working in the community. She said, there are so many more that I didn't even know exist, but this one made her aware mm-hmm. of those things. There's a fascinating interview with Frankfort B. Wilderson III. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not.
He addresses how we as a society situate black people in today's world and the nature of their vulnerability to violence. He addresses what he means by the word slave and what he means when he claims that slavery is social death. What do you think about that?
That sounds very familiar to some of the knowledge that I'm privy to as far as African American studies is concerned. That notion of the social death, the killing of human possibility, the murdering of human opportunity is, I think, what that scholar was talking about there. So I'm familiar mm-hmm. with that. And I agree that it's just the point that enslaving a group of people doesn't just injure the person that it is enslaved, mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about American chattel slavery. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes we don't understand. I have to teach my students because we talk about all parts of the world. And so I always make my students aware of the fact that slavery has been a part of our world since the beginning of time. There's always been people who would enslave another group of people for an economic benefit mm-hmm. or for punishment
and for
debt. Crime.
And for debt.
Or for debt. That's what I meant, so by economic opportunities. Mm-hmm. However, once the Americas got involved in the slavery movement, it changed. It went from being an issue of work to being an issue of property. Mm-hmm. So that's when we say the word chattel, we mean property. Mm-hmm. People who were thought of in the same vein as a cow or a dog mm-hmm. or a broom to be owned mm-hmm. by a person who was basically lazy mm-hmm. and self-righteous. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't call it that, then we miss the big picture. Mm-hmm. And if we don't call it that, then we miss the effects that it had on society. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. A lot of people don't know that during slavery, there was always a population of free people of color. Mm-hmm. every African-American, every person of African descent was not enslaved. And so think about the impact that enslavement had on that population. Well, they had to focus a lot of their energy on trying to figure out how, like the talented 10th, to save their people.
And to stay safe.
And to stay safe, to stay out of harm's way. And that was probably more difficult because they had laws in place where you could actually capture a free African-American and turn them into a slave.
Yes.
And so we have to pull the skirt off of the truth and reveal the truth, so to speak, so that we can move forward. And part of the reason why that's so difficult for us to do is because we haven't agreed on that truth so far.
Well, in terms of the reparation that has begun to be a part of conversation in this country, do you think that social death is the same kind of thing as a trauma that has lived through generations and still affects people of color, particularly Black Americans, African Americans? Does that still sit in the folks today?
Yes, when I spoke earlier about transgenerational trauma, that is in our DNA. And it's emotional, social, and there's one more. And so
probably psychological, Mr.
Yes. And it experienced by first generation, and then it's passed on to each generation afterwards. Now, think of this. The first generation, and it's in our DNA, it's passed on through our DNA. So the first generation has trauma that's passed on, but with each generation are additional traumas that can be picked up and passed on. And so, yes, I totally agree that trauma is passed on generationally. And some of it we are not aware of what that is. And that's why I said earlier, in order to heal, it has to be revealed. Because as a people, we sometimes have put up barriers that just allow us to function and not actually deal with our emotional, social, and psychological trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and institutionalized racism still exists.
Yes.
As evidenced by the fact that, for example, there are no grocery stores in the West End that sell anything that looks like fresh produce. All the corporations that are polluting our environment now, mostly Rubber Town and the West End.
And nobody talks about the redlining and the gentrification of how now the West End is actually being developed, but it's not for the people who live there. It's for the transition of white flight from the East End. You know, they're now doing it when integration happened, when the blacks first moved to the West End, things shut down. So now, yes, lots of things that were there are no longer there. And there are things that are happening now that I think is in preparation for people to move back.
So this big facility complex now that they're just started on in the West End, that's mostly for white people?
They say it's for black. They say it's for blacks. But I'm saying as a holistically, when you look at it, that...
You have to ask yourself who's going to be getting paid off of it. Mm-hmm. then that'll tell you who it's for.
So your interest, Deontay, ranges from young professionals in academia to nonprofit networks and grassroots organizing and activism. Mm-hmm. So give us some insight as to why these endeavors are important to you.
It's part of the training that I've been exposed to in my whole life based on life experiences. First, As a child, I grew up in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, small town.
Really?
All day, every day.
He's from Katy's.
Really? Oh, okay. That's why you got the West Kentucky hat on. But yeah, you from right around my area.
Yeah.
Was that Todd County, Trigg County?
Trigg County.
Trigg County, yeah. Mm-hmm. But so you know then, growing up there, I was born in Paducah, but I was raised in Hopkinsville. And I developed a certain mentality based on the overt segregation I was exposed to. I grew up in neighborhoods where there were no whites. I had one white fellow in my neighborhood when I was growing up, pretty much, and he was real cool too. He passed away. But so my experiences growing up and then going to college at University of Louisville, being in the Pan-African Studies department, I started off majoring in English. I was told that I wasn't a good enough creative writer, which I probably wasn't. That was probably true. But, you know, looking back on it now, I would love to read some of the stuff I wrote back then. Maybe not, but being exposed to...
Don't we all, yeah.
Being exposed to Pan-African studies in my late teens and early 20s helped me to develop the idea of who I wanted to be and what I was going to do with my life. And I remember I had went to a panel discussion about careers or something, and I was late. I'm always late to stuff. I'm working on that. Y'all pray for me. But, there was one individual talking when I came in, and he was like, if you want my job, and he just kept saying, pounding the table, if you want my job, and he's like, if you want my job, you can wake up at 11 o'clock a.m. If you want my job, you can dress however you want. If you want my job, you can read books all day and dude, and I'm like, what is his job? I want his job. He was a college professor. And I was like, okay, so that makes sense. And so from then on, it was about how do I take the idea of being a college professor, mix that with my passion for Pan-African studies and my experience in knowing that I wanted to do some type of community work or activism or community building or whatever. So this is what you get when you mix those things. And it's been a nice little ride. And I've been exposed to people like the folks at Peace Ed and 291 and Spalding and all of these great institutions that believe in what I do. And I always tell them, and Ms. Deborah will tell you this, when you get Deontay Hollowell, you're getting a certain package. It's a certain thing. It's a certain brand. It's me. And it's often uncompromising, but sometimes I can be. But at the same time, I bring a lot of passion, a lot of expertise. I'm smart enough to know what I don't know. And I care enough to do the very least of jobs in order to make things right. So it's been one of those things that it's like a dream come true to be able to do some of the things I've been blessed to do.
So, Dr. Deontay Hollowell, you made the 2019 faculty colloquium presentation titled Policing the Black Experience. You presented research into the African-American community and police relations and discussed the creation of a course to teach dealing with these themes. That course is part of the African-American Studies at the School of Liberal Studies at Spalding, and you have developed that course. So can you give us a gist of Policing the Black Experience, what that means?
So the work that went into making that course came from my dissertation, which is titled Control and Resistance, an Afrocentric Analysis of the Historical and Current Relationship Between African Americans and Police. And that's a real long title. So
that means...
The title means it's just a way for me to analyze the history of police in African-American communities, simply put.
Okay.
I always find it responsible of instructors or professors to have a catchy title to courses that don't say intro to something, or, you know, the university wants you to have the intro courses and these sort of things, the survey courses. But once you get to the 300 level or above, you get to kind of play with course titles that you think will have students like, yes, I want to take that. And so I wanted to make the course title something very brief, something interesting, something provocative, innovative. And that's what I came up with. And I think it worked because I think students were like, what in the world is he going to do in this class? And so really what I did, and just...
Policing the Black Experience.
Policing the Black Experience, yeah. Right. And so I wanted students to get a picture of what it would be like to be inside the Black Experience. And then I wanted them to think about what it would be like to control the Black Experience from the outside. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think policing has often attempted to do. And so we start with the enslavement of Africans under chattel slavery in America, even though there was no police department in America at that time. Why? Because you didn't need one. It was the slave owners, it was the laws, it was the patrollers who policed the Black Experience. And everything that the Black Experience became, it had to become under the guise of these police who were not Black. As a matter of fact, they were not even living the Black Experience. They were controlling it from the other side. And so the whole goal of that class is to talk about how that policing has developed over the centuries. So how did it go from enslavement to and end up at mass incarceration? What happened in the Jim Crow era? What happened in the 60s, the civil rights era, the Black Power Movement era? And how were all of these things linked? back to someone having control from outside of the experience. So we did a lot in that class as it pertains to policing research. We talked about the development of the modern day police departments in the United States as they were developed from the French model. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people didn't realize that the first policing was actually meant to deal with black men who were unemployed. Right out in Jim Crow era, it was illegal for a black man to be unemployed in the South. And so guess what? If you were unemployed, we had a place for you. It's called a chain gang. And so we're going to make sure that you are employed, whether you can be paid or not. And so all of these things are intertwined. And I think that they lead up to the point now where you have, and especially within the last 5 years, all the video evidence of unarmed black men and women being killed at the hands of police. Well, guess what? Unarmed black men and women were killed at the hands of police ever since we came to the U.S. in chains. Mm-hmm. Now, we can talk about what happened before that. And also in the class, we investigate ancient Kemetic or Egyptian practices in policing and compare them to modern day practices, and it blows students' minds.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Some listeners may not know what a chain gang is. What is that?
Where you got basically a prison before the advent of the modern day prison. You had individuals out working, doing one very specific job, whether that's nailing something down or whether that's building a railroad or what have you. And actually, the work itself is based on the work of plantation slavery. Part of the reason why Native American populations were not enslaved in the U.S. was because they were not used to that plantation-style labor. People of African descent in Africa were used to being out in the fields in the 50s and the 100s, working in high-degree temperatures, doing all the same job, whether it was working with corn or whatever the situation may be. So we were used to that. As a matter of fact, we developed very interesting styles on how to do that and make white people think we were working hard when we were really just kind of messing around. So we would make songs, you know, now they're called Negro spirituals, with the Negro spirituals developed from the plantations. And so they would sing the songs and they would actually work to a beat. And so if you ever seen a chain gang, the chain gangs have songs that they work to, then they work to a beat, and they are working really slow. But the people who are watching and not working thinking they're working fast, or they can't say that one person's working slow and one person's working fast. So everybody gets the same amount of credit for the work that they're doing.
Partly because they were actually chained together.
Absolutely. And in this is a sophisticated punishment, first of all, but a very sophisticated labor force also. And people don't realize how much money the United States saves, even currently, off of that labor force, how much money they make currently off of their prison labor force. It would blow your mind.
Slavery and chain gangs and,
Louisville boasts of a citizens' commission on police accountability. It's the board's job as a diverse group to review closed police investigations in all police shootings and incidents and cases involving the loss of life during police action. Is the citizens' commission enough to prevent unnecessary police violence?
It's not. I applaud any evidence of any organization or group that's doing that type of work. I didn't get a call about that. That would have been nice for me to be a part of that type of work. But since I'm not, I won't criticize it. But what I will say is that nothing's enough. You know, enough is enough when I don't have to read about unarmed black people being shot up by police and police walking away from it with no punishment. Now, the person that killed Eric Garner, I think he was fired, but he don't have to go to jail.
Mm-hmm. Five years later.
Right, and it's 5 years later. So my point is, you know, if this happened, first of all, Black Lives Matters, they came up with one slogan, arrest me like I'm white. In other words, if I do something wrong, then arrest me, send me to jail the same way you would do a white person that did the same thing. Then I'm fine. If you have to pull me over, then that's fine, but do it the same way you would do if I were white. Then we won't have any problem. Then the rate of murders that the black community has to witness at the hands of police will be the same. And now we can have a conversation about how to change it on a broader level.
When it comes to racial understanding, I always say it's an education, because training is someone's perspective, but education is facts. So it would be educating those who have the power. So
yes.
I prefer the use of education.
Education, very important, yeah, yeah.
If there are those interested in some of the programs that you are operating or you're developing, how would one be in touch with you?
People can contact me via email, which is just dhollowell@spalding.edu.
My number for Pivot to Peace is 502-589-6510. My email is very long. It's deborah@peaceeducationprogram.org.
And anyone that's dealing with trauma, that has a family member that's been a victim of trauma, or if they themselves have been a victim of trauma, they need to contact Ms. Deborah, because we have dozens of case managers that are ready and willing to help with educational services, career opportunities, medical issues, and anything else. Even if you're trying to get a driver's license or whatever it is, we're not promising that we will do these things for you, but we're going to put you in a position to do these things for yourself.
And lastly, the misinformation is that this program is just for Black people. It's for all people who have experienced gunshot stab and who are living at a high risk of violence or experiencing high risk behavior. It's for all people between the ages of 14, 36, living in Jefferson County.
So I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the work that I do with West Louisville Math and Science Project. It's not necessarily violence prevention work, but we work very hand in hand with the community. And each year we do a math family fun night explosion. And we have probably about 100 or so families. We move it around. We have it in West Louisville every year. But it's an opportunity for people like myself to teach parents how to help their children with math and how to help and make math fun. We talk about science inventions, and I do this whole spiel about Ethiopian multiplication that I could get into right now, but I definitely don't want to bore your listeners. But it's really great, and I wanted to just talk about the work that I do with Sister Ebony, Neil Cochran, and Robin Harrington in that regard. So
it sounds like we have another program to line up.
Yeah, so listeners, we're out of time. So we want to thank Dr. Hallowell and Deborah Barnes-Byers for joining us here in our conversation today on Solutions to Violence. Our program is broadcast on Mondays at 5 p.m., Tuesdays at 8 a.m., and Wednesdays at 6 a.m. You can also listen live stream by Googling forwardradio.org and choosing Listen Live Now. For more information and a schedule of programming that will surprise and delight you, Google Forward Radio and click on Broadcast Schedule.
Ways we wish you our best and hopes that we have brought to you and yours solutions that will fit your needs and create a lifestyle that serves you and your community. Please share your peace and encourage others by your peace to discover their peace.
Thanks
Thank you for listening.